close and kissed him on the head.
So he bringeth them unto their desired haven.
Bree applauded the performance sarcastically, but smiled nonetheless. Jamie had retrieved the cards, shuffling the deck neatly back together. He stopped, looking up. Caught by his sudden stillness, I turned my head to look at him. He glanced at me and smiled.
"The wind has dropped," he said. "Hear it? Tomorrow we'll go out."
The weather had cleared by morning, and a fresh breeze came in from the sea, bearing with it a tang of the shore, smelling of sea lavender, pines, and a strong reek of something maritime rotting in the sun. The quay still exhibited a depressing lack of masts. No large ships lay at anchor, not even a ketch or packet boat, though the water in Wilmington Harbour swarmed with dinghies, rafts, canoes and perettas, the little four-oared boats that flitted across the water like dragonflies, droplets sparkling from their flying oars. One of these spotted our small party standing disconsolately on the wharf and darted toward us, its oarsman calling out to know whether we required transport. As Roger leaned out to shout a polite refusal, the breeze off the harbour whipped away his hat, which whirled giddily out over the brownish waters and lighted on the foam, spinning like a leaf. The craft sculled at once toward the floating hat, and one of the oarsmen speared it deftly, raising it dripping in triumph on the end of his oar. As the peretta drew up beside the quay, though, the boatman's look of jubilation changed to one of astonishment.
"Mackenzie," he cried, "bugger me wi' a silver toothpick if it isn't." "Duff, duff, me old lad."
Roger leaned down and grabbed his hat, then reached back to give his erstwhile acquaintance a hand up. Duff, a small grizzled Scot with a very long nose, sparse jowls, and a fine sprout of greying whiskers that made him look as though he'd been thickly dusted in icing sugar, leapt nimbly up onto the quay and proceeded to clasp Roger in a manly embrace, punctuated by fierce thumpings on the back and ejaculations of amazement, all heartily returned by Roger. The rest of us stood politely watching this reunion, while Massali prevented Germaine from jumping off the quay into the water. "Do you know him?" I asked Brianna, who was dubiously examining her husband's old friend. "I think he might have been on a ship with Roger once," she replied, renewing her grip on Jemmy, who was wildly excited by the sight of seagulls, finding these much more entertaining than Mr. Duff. "Why, look at him!" Duff exclaimed, finally standing back and wiping a sleeve happily under his nose. "A coat like a lairdie's and buttons to match. And the hat! Christ, lad, you're so slick these days, a shit wouldn't stick to you, would it?" Roger laughed and bent to pick up his soggy hat. He slapped it against his thigh to dislodge a strand of bladderwrack and handed it absently to Bree, who was still viewing Mr. Duff with a rather narrow eye.
"My wife,"
Roger introduced her, and waved a hand at the rest of us.
"And her family, Mr. James Fraser, Mrs. Fraser, and my wife's good sister also, Mrs. Mackenzie." "Your servant, sir, ladies."
Duff bowed to Jamie and put a finger to the disreputable object on his head in brief token of respect. He glanced at Brianna, and a broad grin stretched his lips.
"Oh, so you married her. Got her out of the breeks, I see."
He nudged Roger familiarly in the ribs, lowering his voice to a hoarse whisper.
"Did you pay a feather for her, or did he pay you to take her?"
He emitted a creaking noise which I took to be laughter. Jamie and Bree gave Mr. Duff identical cold looks down the bridges of their long, straight noses. But before Roger could reply, the other oarsman shouted something incomprehensible from the boat below.
"Oh, aye, aye, hold your water, man," Mr. Duff waved a quelling hand at his partner. "That's by way of a jest," he explained to me confidentially, "what with us being sailors, Ken. Hold your water, aye? For by you don't hold water, then you'll be at the bottom of the harbour, aye?"
He quivered with merriment, making the creaking noise again.
"Most amusing," I assured him.
"Did he say something about a whale?"
"Oh, to be sure. Was that not why you've come down to the shore this morning?"
Everyone looked blank. "No," Missali said, too bent upon her errand to pay much attention to anything else, including whales.
"Germaine, come back here." "No, sir. We've come to see if there's any word of the octopus. You'll not have heard anything yourself?"
Duff shook his head.
"No, missus, but the weather's been that treacherous off the banks for a month past."
He saw Masali's face go pale and hastened to add,
"A good many ships will have sheered off, see? Gone to another port, maybe, or lying to just off the coast, in hopes of fair skies to make the run in. You recall, Mackenzie, we did that ourselves when we came in with the Gloriana."
"Aye, that's true."
Roger nodded, though his eyes grew wary at mention of the Gloriana. He glanced briefly at Brianna, then back at Duff, and lowered his voice slightly.
"You've parted company with Captain Bonnet, I see."
A small jolt shot through the soles of my feet as though the dock had been electrified. Jamie and Bree both reacted too, though in different fashion. He took an immediate step toward Duff. She took one back.
"Stephen Bonnet,"
Jamie said, eyeing Duff with interest.
"You'll be acquainted with that gentleman, will you?"
"I have been, sir,"
Duff said, and crossed himself. Jamie nodded slowly, seeing this.
"Aye, I see. And will you ken somewhat about Mr. Bonnet's present whereabouts, perhaps?"
"Oh, well, as to that..."
Duff looked up at him speculatively, taking in the details of his clothing and appearance, and obviously wondering exactly how much the answer to that question might be worth. His partner below was growing increasingly restive, though, and shouted impatiently. Masali was restive, too.
"Where might they go, then, if they'd gone to another port? Do you mean stop? You'll fall in next thing."
She bent to retrieve her offspring, who had been hanging over the edge of the wharf, peacefully exploring its underside and hoiking him up onto one hip.
"Bonnet."
Jamie raised his brows, contriving to look simultaneously encouraging and menacing.
"They gone see the whale, or don't they?"
yelled the gentleman in the boat, impatient to be off on more profitable ventures. Duff seemed somewhat at a loss as to whom to reply to first. His small eyes blinked, shifting to and fro between Jamie, Masali, and his increasingly vociferous partner below. I stepped in to break the impasse.
"What's all this about a whale?"
Compelled to focus on this straightforward question, Duff looked relieved.
"Why, the dead whale, missus! A big un, gone aground on the island. I thought sure as you'd all come down to see."
I looked out across the water, and for the first time realised that the boat traffic wasn't entirely random. While a few large canoes and barges were headed toward the mouth of Cape Fear, most of the smaller craft were plying to and fro, disappearing into the distant haze, or returning from it, bearing small groups of passengers. Linen parasols sprouted like pastel mushrooms from the boats, and there was a sprinkling of what were obviously townspeople on the dock, standing as we were, looking expectantly across the harbour.
2 shillings the boatload," Duff suggested ingratiatingly. "Over and back."
Roger, Brianna and Masali looked interested. Jamie looked uneasy.
"And what?"
he asked, with a sceptical glance at the Peretta bobbing gently below. Duff's partner, a gentleman of indeterminate race and language, seemed inclined to take offence at this implied criticism of his craft. But Duff was reassuring.
"Oh, it's dead calm today, sir, dead calm. Why, 'twould be like sitting on a tavern bench."
"Congenial, aye. Very suitable to conversation."
He blinked, innocently affable. Jamie drew a deep breath in through his nose, and I saw him glance once more at the Peretta. Jamie hated boats. On the other hand, he would do far more desperate things than get into a boat in pursuit of Stephen Bonnet. The only question was whether Mr. Duff actually had information to that end, or was only inveigling passengers. Jamie swallowed hard and braced his shoulders, steeling himself to it. Not waiting, Duff reinforced his position by turning craftily to Masali.
"There's a lighthouse on the island, ma'am. You can see a good ways out to sea from the top of that.
See if any ships should be lying off.
Miss Arley's hand dropped at once to her pocket, fumbling for the strings. I observed Germain solicitously poking a dead muscle over her shoulder toward Jemmy's eagerly open mouth, like a mother bird feeding her offspring a nice juicy worm, and tactfully intervened, taking Jemmy into my own arms.
"No, sweetheart," I said, dropping the muscle off the dog. "You don't want that nasty thing. Wouldn't you like to go and see a nice dead whale instead?"
Jamie sighed in resignation and reached for his sporran.
"He'll best call for another boot, then, so's we'll not all drown together."
It was lovely out on the water, with the sun covered by a hazy layer of cloud, and a cool breeze that made me take my hat off for the pleasure of feeling the wind in my hair. While not quite flat calm, the rise and fall of the surf was peacefully lulling to those of us not afflicted by seasickness. I glanced at Jamie's back, but his head was bent, shoulders moving in an easy, powerful rhythm as he rowed. Resigned to the inevitable, he had taken brisk charge of the situation, summoning a second boat and herding Bree, Masali, and the boys into it. Thereupon Jamie had unfastened his brooch and announced that he and Roger would row the remaining peretta, in order that Duff might put himself at ease and thus improve his chances of recollecting interesting facts regarding Stephen Bonnet.
"Less chance of me puking if I've something to do," he muttered to me, stripping off his coat and plaid.
Roger gave a small snort of amusement, but nodded agreeably, shed his own coat and shirt. With Duff and Peter installed at one end of the craft in a state of high hilarity over the turnabout of being paid to be rowed in their own boat, I was told to sit in the other end, facing them.
"Just to keep a bit of an eye on things, Sassenach."
Under cover of the wadded clothes, Jamie wrapped my hand around the stock of his pistol and squeezed gently. He handed me down into the boat, then climbed down gingerly himself, going only slightly pale as the craft swayed and shifted under his weight. It was a calm day, fortunately. A faint haze hung over the water, obscuring the dim shape of Smith Island in the distance. Kittiwakes and terns wheeled in gyres far above, and a heavy-bodied gull seemed to hang immobile in the air nearby, riding the wind as we sculled slowly out into the harbour mouth. Seated just before me, Roger rowed easily, broad bare shoulders flexing rhythmically, obviously accustomed to the exercise. Jamie, on the seat in front of Roger, handled the oars with a fair amount of grace, but somewhat less assurance. He was no sailor, and never would be. Still, the distraction of rowing did seem to be keeping his mind off his stomach, for the moment.
"Oh, I could find myself accustomed to this. What do you say, Peter?"
Duff lifted a long nose into the breeze, half closing his eyes as he savoured the novelty of being rowed. Peter, who appeared to be some exotic blend of Indian and African, grunted in reply, but lounged on the seat beside Duff, equally pleased. He wore nothing but a pair of stained homespun breeches, tied at the waist with a length of tarred rope, and was burned so black by the sun that he might have been a negro, save for the spill of long black hair that fell over one shoulder, decorated with bits of shell and tiny dried starfish tied into it.
"Stephen Bonnet?"
Jamie inquired pleasantly, drawing strongly on the oars.
"Oh, hem!"
Duff looked as though he would have preferred to put off this subject of discussion indefinitely, but a glance at Jamie's face resigned him to the inevitable.
"What do you want to know, then?"
The little man hunched his shoulders warily.
"To begin with, where he is,"
Jamie said, grunting slightly as he hauled on the oars.
"No idea,"
Duff said promptly, looking happier.
"Well, where did you last see the bugger?"
Jamie asked patiently. Duff and Peter exchanged glances.
"Well, no," Duff began cautiously. "Do you mean by see where it was I last clapped in on the captain?"
"What else would he mean, clawfed?"
Roger said, grunting with a backward stroke. Peter nodded thoughtfully, evidently awarding a point to our side, and elbowed Duff in the ribs.
"He was in a pothouse on Roanoke, eating fish pie," Duff said, capitulating. baked with oysters and breadcrumbs on the top, and a pint of dark ale to wash it down. Molasses pudding, too.
You've a keen sense of observation, Mr. Duff, Jamie said. How's your sense of time, then?
Eh? Oh, aye, I take your meaning, man. When was it? 2 months past, about.
And if you were close enough to see what the man was eating, Jamie observed mildly, then I expect you were at table with him, no? What did he speak of?
Duff looked mildly embarrassed. He glanced at me, then up at one of the circling gulls.
Aye, well, the shape of the arse on the barmaid, mostly.
I shouldn't think that a topic of conversation to occupy the course of a meal, even if the lass was particularly shapely,
Roger put in.
Aye, you'd be surprised how much there is to say about a woman's bum, lad, Duff assured him. This one was round as an apple and heavy as a steamed pudding. 'Twas cold as charity in the place, and the thought of having such a plump, hot wee bridie in your hands, oh, meaning no offence to you, ma'am, I'm sure, he added, hurriedly tipping his hat in my direction. None taken, I assured him cordially.
Can you swim, Mr. Duff? Jamie asked,
his tone still one of mild curiosity.
What?
Duff blinked, taken aback.
Well...
No, he can't, Roger said cheerfully. He told me.
Duff gave him a look of outraged betrayal over Jamie's head.
Well, there's loyalty, he said, scandalised. A fine shipmate you are, giving me away so. You should be ashamed of yourself, so you should.
Jamie raised his oars, dripping, out of the water, and Roger followed suit. We were perhaps a quarter mile from shore, and the water beneath our hull was a deep, soft green, portending a bottom several fathoms deep. The boat rocked gently, lifting on the bosom of a long, slow swell.
Bonnet,
Jamie said, still politely, but with a definite edge. Peter folded his arms and closed his eyes, making it clear that the subject had nothing to do with him. Duff sighed and eyed Jamie narrowly.
Aye, well, it's true. I've no notion where the man is. When I saw him on Roanoke, he was making arrangements to have some goods brought in. For what that might be worth to you, he added, rather ungraciously.
What goods? Brought in where?
And going where?
Jamie was leaning on his shipped oars, apparently casual. I could see a certain tension in the line of his body, though, and it occurred to me that while his attention might be fixed on Duff's face, he was, of necessity, also watching the horizon behind Duff, which was rising and falling hypnotically as the swell lifted the Peretta and let it drop. Over and over and...
Teaches was what I took in for him, Duff answered warily. Goodness eh, for the rest.
The rest?
Christ, man, every boat on this water brings in the odd bit of jiggery-pokery here and there. Surely you ken that much.
Peter's eyes had opened to half slits. I saw them rest on Jamie's face with a certain expression of interest. The wind had shifted a few points, and the smell of dead whale was decidedly stronger. Jamie took a slow, deep breath and let it out again, rather faster.
You brought in tea, then? Where from? A ship?
Aye.
Duff was watching Jamie, too, in growing fascination. I shifted uneasily on the narrow seat. I couldn't tell from the back of his neck, but I thought it more than likely that he was beginning to turn green.
The Sparrow, Duff went on, eyes fixed on Jamie. She anchored off the banks, and the boats went out to her. We loaded the cargo and came in through Jode's Inlet. Come ashore at Wiley's Landing and handed over to a fellow there.
What fellow?
The wind was cool, but I could see sweat trickling down the back of Jamie's neck, dampening his collar and plastering the linen between his shoulders. Duff didn't answer immediately. A look of speculation flickered in his small, deep-set eyes.
Don't think about it, Duff,
Roger said softly, but with great assurance.
I can reach you from here with an oar, Ken.
Aye.
Duff glanced thoughtfully from Jamie to Roger and then to me.
Yeah, I reckon you might. But allowing for the sake of argument as how you can swim, Mackenzie, and even that Mr. Fraser might keep afloat. I don't think that's true of the lady, is it? Skirts and petticoats.
He shook his head, pursing thin lips in speculation as he looked at me.
Go to the bottom like a stone, she would.
Peter shifted ever so slightly, bringing his feet under him.
Claire,
Jamie said. I saw his fingers curl tight round the oars and heard the note of strain in his voice. I sighed and drew the pistol out from under the coat across my lap. Right, I said. Which one shall I shoot? Peter's eyes snapped open, wide enough that I saw a rim of white show all round his black pupils. He looked at the pistol, then at Duff, then directly at Jamie.
Give tea to a man named Butler, he said. Work for Miss Lyon.
He pointed at me, then at Duff.
Shoot him, he suggested.
The ice thus broken, it took very little time for our two passengers to confide the rest of what they knew, pausing only momentarily for Jamie to be sick over the side between questions. Smuggling was, as Duff had suggested, so common in the area as to constitute general business practice. Most of the merchants and all of the small boatmen in Wilmington engaged in it, as did most others on the Carolina coast, in order to avoid the crippling duties on officially imported goods. Stephen Bonnet, however, was not only one of the more successful smugglers, but also rather a specialist.
"Brings in goods to order, like,"
Duff said, twisting his neck in order to scratch more effectively between his shoulder blades. "And in what you might call quantity."
"How much quantity?"
Jamie's elbows rested on his knees, his head sunk onto his hands. It seemed to be helping. His voice was steady. Duff pursed his lips and squinted, calculating.
"There were six of us at the tavern on Roanoke. Six wee small boats, I mean, as could run the inlets. If we were each to be fetching along as much as we could manage, say 50 chests of tea, all told, then."
"And he brings in such a load how often? Every 2 months?"
Roger had relaxed a little, leaning on his oars. I hadn't, and gave Duff a hard eye over the pistol to indicate as much.
"Oh, more often than that," Duff answered, eyeing me warily. "Couldn't say exactly, but you hear talk, aye? From what the other boats say, I reckon he's got a load coming every 2 weeks in the season, somewhere on the coast betwixt Virginia and Charleston."
Roger gave a brief grunt of surprise at that, and Jamie looked up briefly from his cupped hands.
"What about the Navy?" he asked. "Who's he paying?"
That was a good question. While small boats might escape the Navy's eye, Bonnet's operation evidently involved large quantities of contraband coming in on large ships. It would be hard to hide something on that scale. And the obvious answer was that he wasn't bothering to hide it. Duff shook his head and shrugged.
"Can't see, man."
"But you haven't worked for Bonnet since February," I asked. "Why not?" Duff and Peter exchanged a glance.
"You eat scorpion fish. You hungry?" Peter said to me. "You don't eat 'em if you got something better."
"What?"
"The man's dangerous, Sassenach," Jamie translated dryly. "They dinna like to deal with him, save for need." "Well, see him, Bonnet," Duff said, warming to the topic. "He's no bad at all to deal with, so long as your interest runs with his. Only, if it might be as all of a sudden it doesna quite run with his."
Peter solemnly drew a finger across his stringy neck, nodding in affirmation.
"And it's no as if there's warning about it either," Duff added, nodding too. "One minute it's whisky and cigars, the next you're on your back in the sawdust breathing blood. And happy still to be breathing at that." "A temper, has he?"
Jamie drew a hand down over his face, then wiped his sweaty palm on his shirt. The linen clung damply to his shoulders, but I knew he wouldn't take it off. Duff, Peter and Roger all shook their heads simultaneously at the question.
"Cold as ice," Roger said,
and I heard the small note of strain in his voice.
"Kill you without the turn of an ass hair," Duff assured Jamie.
Rip you like dem whale,
Peter put in helpfully with a wave toward the island. The current had carried us a good deal closer to the land, and I could see the whale as well as smell it. Seabirds whirled and screamed in a great cloud over the carcass, swooping down to tear away gobbets of flesh, and a small crowd of people clustered nearby, hands to their noses, clearly clutching handkerchiefs and sachets. Just then the wind changed, and a fetid gust of decay washed over us like a breaking wave. I clapped Roger's shirt to my own face, and even Peter appeared to pale.
"Mother of God, have mercy on me," Jamie said under his breath. "I... oh, Christ!"
He leaned to the side and threw up repeatedly. I nudged Roger in the buttock with my toe.
"Row," I suggested.
Roger obeyed with alacrity, putting his back into it, and within a few minutes the keel of the Peretta touched sand. Duff and Peter leapt out to run the hull up onto the beach, then gallantly assisted me out of the boat, evidently not holding the pistol against me. Jamie paid them, then staggered a short distance up the beach and sat down, quite suddenly, in the sand beneath a loblolly pine. He was roughly the same shade as the dead whale, a dirty grey with white blotches.
"Will we wait for you, sir, and row you back?"
Duff, his purse now bulging healthily, hovered helpfully over Jamie.
"No," Jamie said. "Take them."
He waved feebly at me and Roger, then closed his eyes and swallowed heavily.
"As for me, I believe I shall just swim back."
This ends Disc 42. The Fiery Cross, Disc 43.
Chapter 101. Monsters and Heroes. The little boys were mad to see the whale, and tugged their reluctant mothers along like kites. I came along, keeping a somewhat more discreet distance from the towering carcass, leaving Jamie on the beach to recover. Roger took Duff aside for a bit of private conversation, while Peter subsided into somnolence in the bottom of the boat. The carcass was newly washed up on the beach, though it must have been dead for some time before its landing. Such an impressive state of decomposition must have taken days to develop. The stench notwithstanding, a number of the more intrepid visitors were standing on the carcass, waving cheerily to their companions on the beach below, and a gentleman, armed with a hatchet, was employed in hacking chunks of flesh from the side of the animal, dropping these into a pair of large buckets. I recognised him as the proprietor of an ordinary on Hawthorne Street, and made a mental note to strike that establishment from our list of potential eating places. Numbers of small crustaceans, not nearly so fastidious in their habits, swarmed merrily over the carcass, and I saw several people, also armed with buckets, picking up the larger crabs and crayfish off like ripe fruit. 10 million sand fleas had joined the circus too, and I retreated to a safe distance, rubbing my ankles. I glanced back down the beach, seeing that Jamie had risen now and joined the conversation. Duff was looking increasingly restive, glancing back and forth from the whale to his boat. Clearly, he was anxious to return to business before the attraction should disappear altogether. At last he succeeded in escaping and scampered away toward his Peretta, looking hunted. Jamie and Roger came toward me, but the little boys were clearly not ready yet to leave the whale. Brianna nobly volunteered to watch them both, so that Massali could climb the nearby lighthouse tower to see whether there might be any sign of the octopus.
"What have you been saying to poor Mr. Duff?" I asked Jamie. "He looked rather worried."
"Aye, no need of worry," he said, glancing toward the water where Duff's Peretta was rapidly pulling back to the quay. "I've only put a wee bit of business in his way." "He knows where Lion is,"
Roger put in. He looked disturbed but excited.
"And Mr. Lion knows where Bonnet is, or if not where precisely, at least how to get word to him. Let's go a bit higher, aye?"
Jamie was still pale. He gestured toward the stair of the tower with his chin, wiping sweat from the side of his neck. The air was fresher at the top of the tower, but I had little attention to spare for the view out over the ocean. "And So? I said, not sure I wanted to hear the answer.
So I've commissioned Duff to carry a message to Mr. Lyon. All being agreeable, we will meet with Mr. Bonnet at Wiley's Landing in a week's time.
I swallowed, feeling a wave of dizziness that had nothing to do with the height. I closed my eyes, clutching the wooden rail that surrounded the tiny platform we stood on. The wind was blowing hard, and the boards of the tower creaked and groaned, feeling frighteningly insubstantial. I heard Jamie shift his weight, moving toward Roger.
"He is a man, Ken," he said quietly, "not a monster."
Was he?
It was a monster, I thought, who haunted Brianna, and perhaps her father.
Would killing him reduce him, make him no more than a man again?
"I know."
Roger's voice was steady but lacked conviction. I opened my eyes to see the ocean falling away before me into a bank of floating mist. It was vast and beautiful and empty.
One might well fall off the end of the world, I thought. "You sailed with our Steve and I for what, 2 months? 3? "Near on 3," Roger answered.
"Our Stephen, was it? And what did Jamie mean by that homely usage, then?" Jamie nodded, not turning his head. He looked out over the rolling wash of the sea, the breeze whipping strands of hair loose from their binding to dance like flames, pale in the daylight.
"You'll have kent the man well enough, then."
Roger leaned his weight against the rail. It was solid, but wet and sticky with half-dried spray, where spume from the rocks below had reached it.
"Well enough," he echoed. "Aye. Well enough for what?"
Jamie turned then to look him in the face. His eyes were narrowed against the wind, but straight and bright as razors.
"Well enough to ken he is a man, and no more. What else would he be?"
Roger felt the edge in his own voice. Jamie turned back toward the sea, shading his eyes with his hand as he looked toward the sinking sun.
"A monster," he said softly. "Something less than a man. Or more."
Roger opened his mouth to reply, but found he couldn't, for it was a monster that shadowed his own heart with fear. "How did the sailors see him?" Claire's voice came from Jamie's other side. She leaned over the rail to look around him, and the wind seized her hair and shook it out in a flying cloud, stormy as the distant sky.
"On the Gloriana?"
Roger took a deep breath, a whiff of dead whale mingling with the fecund scent of the salt marsh behind.
"They respected him. Some of them were afraid of him. Like me. He had the reputation of a hard captain, but a good one, competent. Men were willing to ship with him because he always came safe into port. His voyages were always profitable."
"Was he cruel?" Claire asked. A faint line showed between her brows.
"All captains are cruel sometimes, Sassenach," Jamie said with a slight tinge of impatience. "They need to be."
She glanced up at him, and Roger saw her expression change, memory softening her eyes, a wry thought tightening the corner of her mouth. She laid a hand on Jamie's arm, and he saw her knuckles whiten as she squeezed.
"You've never done other than you had to," she said,
so quietly that Roger could scarcely hear her. No matter. The words were plainly not meant for him. She raised her voice then, slightly.
"There's a difference between cruelty and necessity."
"Aye," Jamie said, half under his breath. "And a thin line, maybe, between a monster and a hero."
Chapter 102. The Battle of Wiley's Landing. The sound was calm and flat, the surface barely ruffled by tiny wind-driven waves.
"And a bloody good thing, too," Roger thought, looking at his father-in-law.
Jamie had his eyes open, at least, fixed on the shore with a sort of desperate intensity, as though the sight of solid land, however unreachable, might yet impart some comfort. Droplets of sweat gleamed on his upper lip, and his face was the same nacreous colour as the dawn sky, but he hadn't vomited yet.
Roger wasn't seasick, but he felt nearly as ill as Jamie looked. Neither of them had eaten any breakfast, but he felt as though he'd swallowed a large mass of porridge, liberally garnished with carpet tacks.
"That's it!"
Duff sat back on his oars, nodding toward the wharf ahead. It was cool on the water, almost cold at this hour, but the air was thick with moisture, and sweat ran down his face from his efforts. Peter sat silent on his own oars, dark face set in an expression indicating that he wanted nothing to do with this enterprise, and the sooner their unwelcome cargo disembarked, the better. Wiley's Landing seemed like a mirage floating in a layer of mist above the water amid a thick growth of needle rush and cord grass. Marshland, clumps of stunted coastal forest, and broad stretches of open water surrounded it under an overwhelming arch of pale grey sky. By comparison to the green enclosures of the mountains, it seemed uncomfortably exposed. At the same time, it was completely isolated, evidently miles from any other sign of human habitation. That was in part illusion. Roger knew that the plantation house was no more than a mile from the landing, but it was hidden by a dense growth of scraggy-looking forest that sprang from the marshy ground like some misshapen, dwarfish Sherwood, thick with vines and brush. The landing itself consisted of a short wooden dock on pilings and a collection of ramshackle sheds adjoining it, weathered to a silver grey that seemed about to disappear into the lowering sky. A small open boat was drawn up on the shore, hull upturned. A zigzag split-rail fence enclosed a small pen beyond the sheds. Wiley must ship livestock by water now and then. Jamie touched the cartridge box that hung at his belt, either for reassurance or perhaps only to ensure that it was still dry. His eyes went to the sky, assessing, and Roger realised with a sudden qualm that if it rained, the guns might not be dependable. Black powder clumped in the damp, more than a trace of moisture, and it wouldn't fire at all. And the last thing he wanted was to find himself facing Stephen Bonnet with a useless gun. "He is a man, no more," he repeated silently to himself. Let Bonnet swell to supernatural proportions in his mind, and he was doomed. He groped for some reassuring image, and fastened on a memory of Stephen Bonnet, seated in the head of the Gloriana, breeches puddled round his bare feet, blonde stubbled jaw slack in the morning light, his eyes half closed in the pleasure of taking a peaceful crap. "Shit," he thought. "Think of Bonnet as a monster, and it became impossible. Think of him as a man, and it was worse. And yet, it had to be done." His palms were sweating. He rubbed them on his breeks, not even bothering to try to hide it. There was a dirk on his belt, along with a pair of pistols. The sword lay in the bottom of the boat, solid in its scabbard. He thought of John Gray's letter and Captain Marsden's eyes, and tasted something bitter and metallic at the back of his throat. At Jamie's direction, the Pareto drew slowly nearer the landing, everyone on board alert for any sign of life. "No one lives here?" Jamie asked, low-voiced, leaning over Duff's shoulder to scan the buildings. "No slaves?"
"No," Duff said, grunting as he pulled. "Wilner doesn't use the landing so often these days, for he's built a new road from his house. Goes inland and joins with the main road toward Edenton."
Jamie gave Duff a cynical glance.
"And if Wiley doesn't use it, there are others who do, eh?"
Roger could see that the landing was well situated for casual smuggling, out of sight from the landward side, but easily accessible from the sound. What he had at first taken for an island to their right was in fact a maze of sandbars separating the channel that led to Wiley's Landing from the main sound. He could see at least four smaller channels leading into the sandbanks, two of them wide enough to accommodate a good-sized ketch. Duff chuckled under his breath.
"There's a wee shell road as leads to the house, man," he said. "If anyone should come that way, you'll have fair warning."
Peter stirred restively, jerking his head toward the sandbars.
"Tide," he muttered. "Oh, aye, you'll no have long to wait. Or you will, depending."
Duff grinned, evidently thinking this funny.
Why?
Jamie said gruffly, not sharing the amusement. He was looking somewhat better now that escape was at hand, but was obviously in no mood yet for jocularity.
The tide's coming in.
Duff stopped rowing and leaned on his oars long enough to remove his disreputable cap and wipe his balding brow. He waved the cap at the sandbars, where a crowd of small shorebirds were running up and down in evident dementia.
When the tide's out, the channel's too shallow to flew to catch. In 2 hours...
He squinted at the glow in the east that marked the sun's rising and nodded to himself.
Or a bit more. They can come in. If they're waiting out there now, they'll come in at once so as to finish the job and get off again before the tide turns. But if they've not come yet, they'll maybe need to wait for the evening surge. It's a chancy job to risk the channels by night. But Bonnet knew the lad to be put off by a bit of darkness.
Still, if he's in a rush, he might well delay till next morning. Aye, you might have a bit of a wait.
Roger realised he had been holding his breath. He let it out and drew a deep, slow breath, smelling of salt and pines with a faint stink of dead shellfish. So, it would be soon. Or perhaps not till after nightfall, or not until the next day's dawn. He hoped it would be soon, and hoped, at the same time, that it wouldn't. The Peretta slid in close to the wharf, and Duff thrust out an oar against one of the barnacle-crusted pilings, swinging the tiny boat deftly alongside. Jamie hoisted himself up onto the dock with alacrity, eager to reach dry land. Roger handed up the swords and the small bundle that contained their canteens and spare powder, then followed. He knelt on the dock, all his senses alert for the slightest sound of human movement, but heard nothing but the liquid singing of blackbirds in the marsh and the cry of gulls on the sound. Jamie rummaged in his pouch and pulled out a small purse, which he tossed down to Duff with a nod.
No more need be said. This was a token payment. The rest would be paid when Duff returned for them. In 2 days.
Jamie had waited till the last possible moment to make the arrangements, ensuring that Bonnet at least would be unreachable until after the meeting, the ambush, had taken place. If it was successful, Jamie would pay the rest of the money agreed. If it was not, Claire would pay. He had a vision of Claire's face, pale and drawn, nodding in stiff-lipped agreement as Jamie explained the arrangements to Duff. Her eyes had flicked to Duff then, with the fierce yellow ruthlessness of a hawk about to eviscerate a rat, and he had seen Duff flinch at the implicit threat. He hid a smile at the memory. If friendship and money were insufficient to keep Duff's mouth shut, perhaps fear of the White Lady should suffice. They stood silently together on the dock, watching the Peretta pull slowly away. The knot in Roger's stomach tightened. He would have prayed, but could not. He couldn't ask help for such a thing as he meant now to do. Not from God, or Michael the Archangel. Not from the Reverend, or his parents. Only from Jamie Fraser. He wondered now and then how many men Fraser had killed. If he counted. If he knew. It was a different thing, of course, to kill a man in battle or in self-defence than to lie in ambush for him, planning murder in cold blood. Still, surely it would be easier for Fraser, what they meant to do. He glanced at Fraser and saw him watching the boat pull away. He stood still as stone, and Roger saw that his eyes were fixed somewhere far beyond the boat, beyond the sky and water, looking on some evil thing, not blinking. Fraser took a deep breath and swallowed hard. No, it wouldn't be easier for him. Somehow, that seemed a comfort. They explored all the sheds briefly, finding nothing but scattered rubbish, broken packing crates, heaps of mouldy straw, a few gnawed bones left by dogs or slaves. One or two of the sheds had evidently once been used as living quarters, but not recently. Some animal had built a large, untidy nest against the wall of one shed, When Jamie prodded it with a stick, a plump grey rodent-like thing shot out, ran between Roger's feet, and sailed off the dock into the water with an unnerving splash. They took up quarters in the largest shed, which was built on the wharf itself, and settled down to wait, more or less. The plan was simplicity itself. Shoot Bonnet the instant he appeared. Unless it rained, in which case it would be necessary to employ swords or knives. Stated like that, the procedure sounded altogether straightforward. Roger's imagination, though, was unable to leave it at that.
"Walk about if you like," Jamie said, after a quarter hour of watching Roger fidget. "We'll hear him come."
He himself sat tranquil as a frog on a lily pad, methodically checking the assortment of weapons laid out before him.
"Mm-hmm. What if he doesn't come?"
Jamie shrugged, eyes fixed on the flint of the pistol in his hand. He wiggled it to be sure it was firmly seated, then set the gun down.
"Then he does not. If there are men with him, we must separate him from them. I shall take him into one of the small sheds, on pretext of private conversation, and dispatch him there. You keep anyone from following. I shall not require more than a minute."
"Oh, aye. And then you come strolling out and inform his men you've just done for their captain. And then what?" Roger demanded.
Jamie rubbed a hand down the bridge of his nose and shrugged again.
"He'll be dead. Do you think he's the man to inspire such loyalty as would make his men seek vengeance for him?"
"Well, no," Roger said slowly. "Perhaps not."
Bonnet was the type to inspire hard work from his men, but it was labour based on fear and the hope of profit, not love.
"I've discovered a good deal regarding Mr. Bonnet," Jamie observed, laying down the pistol. "He has regular associates, aye, but he doesn't have particular friends. He doesn't sail always with the same mate, the same crew, which sea captains often do when they find a few men who suit them well. Bonnet picks his crews as chance provides, and he chooses them for strength or skill, not for liking. That being so, I wouldn't expect to find any great liking for him among them."
Roger nodded, acknowledging the truth of this observation. Bonnet had run a tight ship on the Gloriana, but there'd been no sense of camaraderie, even with his mates and bosun. And it was true what Jamie said. Everything they had learned suggested that Bonnet picked up assistance as he required them. If he brought men with him to this rendezvous, they were unlikely to be a devoted lieutenant and crew. More likely sailors picked at random off the docks.
"All right, but if, when we kill him, any men with him will be in need of new employment," Jamie interrupted. "Nay, so long as we take care not to fire upon them or give them reason to think we threaten them, I dunna think they'll trouble our much about Bonnet's fate."
"Still..." He picked up his sword, frowning slightly, and slid it in and out of the scabbard to be sure it moved easily.
"I think, if that should be the situation, then I will take Bonnet aside, as I said. Give me a minute to deal with him, then make some excuse, and come as though to fetch me. Dinna stop, though. Go straight through the sheds and head for the trees. I'll come and meet you there."
Roger eyed Jamie sceptically.
"Christ, the man made it sound like a Sunday outing. A turn by the river and we'll meet in the park. I'll bring ham sandwiches and you fetch the tea."
He cleared his throat, cleared it again, and picked up one of his own pistols. The feel of it was cool and solid in his hand, a reassuring weight.
"Aye, then. Just the one thing. I'll take Bonnet."
Fraser glanced sharply at him. He kept his own eyes steady, listening to the pulse that had begun to hammer hard inside his ears. He saw Fraser start to speak, then stop. The man stared thoughtfully at him, and he could hear the arguments hammering on his inner ear with his pulse, as plainly as if they'd been spoken aloud.
"You have never killed a man, nor even fought in battle. You are no marksman and only half decent with a sword. Worse, you are afraid of the man. And if you try and fail..." "I know," he said aloud to Fraser's deep blue stare. "He's mine. I'll take him. Brianna's your daughter, aye.
but she's my wife.
Fraser blinked and looked away. He drummed his fingers on his knee for a moment, then stopped, drawing breath in a deep sigh. He drew himself slowly upright and turned toward Roger once again, eyes straight.
"It is your right," he said formally. "So then, dinna hesitate, dinna challenge him. Kill him the instant you have the chance."
He paused for a moment, then spoke again, eyes steady on Roger's.
"If you fall, though, know I will avenge you."
The nail-studded mass in his belly seemed to have moved upwards, sticking in his throat. He coughed to shift it and swallowed.
"Great," he said. "And if you fall, I'll avenge you. A bargain, is it?"
Fraser didn't laugh. And in that moment, Roger understood why men would follow him anywhere, to do anything. He only looked at Roger for a long moment, and then nodded.
"A rare bargain," he said softly. "Thank you."
Taking the dirk from his belt, he began to polish it. They had no timepiece, but they didn't need one. Even with the sky shrouded in low-lying clouds and the sun invisible, it was possible to feel the creep of minutes, the gradual shift of the earth as the rhythms of the day changed. Birds that had sung at dawn ceased singing, and the ones who hunted in morning began. The sound of water lapping against the pilings changed in tone as the rising tide echoed in the space beneath the wharf. The time of high tide came and passed. The echo beneath the wharf began to grow hollow as the water started to drop. The pulse in Roger's ears began to slacken, along with the knots in his gut. Then something struck the dock, and the vibration juddered through the floor of the shed. Jamie was up in an instant, two pistols through his belt, another in his hand. He cocked his head at Roger, then disappeared through the door. Roger jammed his own pistol securely in his belt, touched the hilt of his dirk for reassurance, and followed. He caught a quick glimpse of the boat, the dark wood of its rail just showing above the edge of the wharf, and then was inside the smaller shed to the right. Jamie was nowhere in sight. He'd got to his own post then, to the left. He pressed himself against the wall, peering out through the slit afforded between hinge and door. The boat was drifting slowly along the edge of the dock, not yet secured. He could just see a bit of the stern. The rest was out of sight. No matter. He couldn't fire until Bonnet appeared on the wharf. He wiped his palm on his breeks and drew the better of his two pistols, checking for the thousandth time that priming and flint were in order. The metal of the gun smelled sharp and oily in his hand. The air was damp. His clothes stuck to him. Would the powder fire? He touched the dirk for the 10,000th time, running through Fraser's instructions on killing with a knife. Hand on his shoulder, drive it up beneath the breastbone, hard. From behind, the kidney, up from under. God, could he do it face to face? Yes, he hoped it would be face to face. He wanted to see. A coil of rope hit the dock. He heard the heavy thump and then the scramble and thud of someone springing over the rail to tie up. A rustle and a grunt of effort. A pause. He closed his eyes, trying to hear through the thunder of his heart. Steps. Slow, but not furtive. Coming toward him. The door stood half ajar. He stepped silently to the edge of it, listening. Waiting. A shadow, dim in the cloudy light, fell through the door. The man stepped in. He lunged out from behind the door and flung himself bodily at the man, knocking him back into the wall with a hollow thud. The man whooped in surprise at the impact, and the sound of the cry stopped him just as he got his hands round a distinctly unmasculine throat. "Shit," he said. "I mean, I beg your pardon, ma'am." She was pressed against the wall, all his weight on her, and he was well aware that the rest of her was unmasculine too. Blood, hot in his cheeks, he released her and stepped back, breathing heavily. She shook herself like a dog, straightening her garments and tenderly touching the back of her head where it had struck the wall.
"I'm sorry," he said, feeling both shocked and a complete prat. "I didn't mean... Are you hurt?"
The girl was as tall as Brianna, but more solidly built, with dark brown hair and a handsome face, broad-boned and deep-eyed. She grinned at Roger and said something incomprehensible, strongly scented with onions. She looked him up and down in a bold sort of way, then, evidently approving, put her hands under her breast in a gesture of unmistakable invitation, jerking her head toward a corner of the shed where mounds of damp straw gave off a fecund scent of not unpleasant decay.
Roger said, "No. I'm afraid you're mistaken. No, don't touch that. No. No. Nein."
He fumbled with her hands, which seemed determined to unfasten his belt. She said something else in the unfamiliar tongue. He didn't understand a word, but he got the sense of it well enough.
"No. I'm a married man. Would you stop?"
She laughed, gave him a flashing glance from under long black lashes, and renewed her assault on his person. He would have been convinced he was hallucinating were it not for the smell. Engaged at close quarters, he realised that onions were the least of it. She wasn't filthy to look at, but had the deep-seated reek of someone just off a long sea voyage. He recognised that smell at once. Beyond that, though, the unmistakable scent of pigs wafted from her skirts.
"Excusez-moi, mademoiselle."
Jamie's voice came from somewhere behind him, sounding rather startled. The girl was startled too, though not frightened. She let go of his balls, though, allowing him to step back. Jamie had a pistol drawn, though he held it by his side. He raised one eyebrow at Roger.
"Who's this, then? How in hell should I know?"
Struggling for composure, Roger shook himself back into some kind of order.
"I thought she was Bonnet or one of his men, but evidently not."
"Evidently."
Fraser seemed disposed to find something humorous in the situation. A muscle near his mouth was twitching fiercely.
"Qui êtes-vous, mademoiselle?"
he asked the girl. She frowned at him, clearly not understanding, and said something in the odd language again. Both Jamie's brows rose at that.
"Who is she speaking?"
Roger asked.
"I've no idea."
His look of amusement tinged with wariness, Jamie turned toward the door, raising his pistol.
"Watch her eye. She'll no be alone."
This was clear. There were voices on the wharf. A man's voice and another woman. Roger exchanged baffled glances with Jamie.
No,
the voice was neither Bonnet's nor Lyons. And what in God's name are all these women doing here? The voices were coming closer, though, and the girl suddenly called out something in her own language. It didn't sound like a warning, but Jamie quickly flattened himself beside the door, pistol at the ready and his other hand on his dirk. The narrow door darkened almost completely, and a dark, shaggy head thrust into the shed. Jamie stepped forward and shoved his pistol up under the chin of a very large, very surprised-looking man. Seizing the man by the collar, Jamie stepped backward, drawing him into the shed. The man was followed almost at once by a woman whose tall, solid build and handsome face identified her at once as the girl's mother. The woman was blonde, though, while the man, the girl's father, was as dark as the bear he strongly resembled. He was nearly as tall as Jamie, but almost twice as broad, massive through the chest and shoulders, and heavily bearded. None of them appeared to be at all alarmed. The man looked surprised. The woman affronted. The girl laughed heartily, pointing at Jamie, then at Roger.
"I begin to feel rather foolish," Jamie said to Roger.
Removing the pistol, he stepped back warily.
"Wer seid ihr?" he said.
"I don't think they're German,"
Roger said.
"She."
He jerked a thumb at the girl who was now eyeing Jamie in an appraising sort of way, as though sizing up his potential for sport in the straw.
"Then I seem to understand either French or German, though perhaps she was pretending."
The man had been frowning, glancing from Jamie to Roger in an attempt to make out what they were saying. At the word French, though, He seemed to brighten.
"Comment ça va?"
he said, in the most execrable accent Roger had ever heard.
"Parlez-vous français?"